Okay, welcome back. The gods are smiling on Wimbledon. We're here. So, I'm going to talk a little bit about mindfulness practice of awareness, with reference to this particular text that I mentioned earlier that the Buddha gave. So just a couple of things to say. I've got lots of notes here, but don't worry. I'm not going to say everything I've got written down. I'm going to draw on them. And if it feels a bit too much, just really listen for anything that resonates with you. You know, I was thinking of the Dharma talk. If we go home with one point, one or two take-home messages, it all builds over the months and years. So some of it, you know, if it feels a bit dense, just really don't try and take it all in. Just notice what feels useful, what resonates with you. So it's interesting in a way, although meditation is considered pretty essential and central in most Buddhist traditions to practice, there's relatively little instruction in the ancient texts. The texts I'm drawing on are from the Pali Canon, which are probably the earliest texts that have come down to us, and certainly that have been translated fully into English. Pali was an ancient Indian language, very, very close to the actual language of the Buddha, if not the same. I won't get into that debate. So this is a very key text that I'm going to be talking about, but it's very rare that the Buddha's instructions on mindfulness, and it's also quite open to interpretation. I think probably because a lot of meditation instruction, even then, even at the time of the Buddha, would have been given more personally from teacher to student rather than written down. And the text itself, if you want to find it, it's available on a website called accesstoinsight.org, and definitely worth looking up, so I can give you the reference later if you wish. I'm not going to read it all out, I'm just going to refer to it. So it's usually translated as the teaching on four applications of mindfulness, or four foundations, but it's a more active process than foundations. Four ways that we can establish awareness. And it goes into really why we practice, the very beginning. There's a statement of why we practice. There's quite a long exploration of what we practice, what we place mindfulness on, and there's a little bit on how we practice that's repeated throughout the text. So I'm going to try and say a little about each of those. But before I do that, just worth saying, well, what do we mean by mindfulness? The word, this has become, you know, very frequently used word now in modern English. It was chosen by some 19th century translator and it stuck. And in some ways it's quite a good translation. The mind is being full of attention and awareness. But it's from a root, the original Pali word sati is from a root that means to remember. So not in the sense of, you know, sitting reminiscing. Often that is what's happening in our meditation. That's not mindfulness. But it has a sense of continuity. So it's often defined in terms of paying attention in the present moment. John Kabat-Zinn says paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. But there is an element of recollection, of bearing something in mind, remembering our intention. So there's more to it than just being in the now, just being here and now. And it's also considered in the tradition to be a wholesome mental state, a skillful or, you know, ethically good mental state, which is implicit in the text rather than stated, but it's worth remembering, really. This is not the concentrated attention of somebody who's creeping around your living room while you're asleep upstairs, making off with your smart TV. That's attention, but it's not mindfulness in this sense. And that raises perhaps some questions about ethics and mindfulness that I don't want to pursue here. Just really worth bearing that in mind. So the Buddha gave this teaching in a town near what's modern Delhi, which is a little bit outside of his usual stomping ground. I've no idea the significance of that, except that perhaps it implies that this is a reliable tradition. You know, it's very precise about where the text was given. But the first thing he says is to summarize this question of why we should practice. What is this path all about? So he says, he uses the word monks. So when you hear monks, you need to assume monks, nuns and lay people. It really just means all the practitioners that he was addressing. So he says, this is a sure path for the purification of beings, to overcome sorrow and grief, to end suffering and discontent, to find an effective training and to experience release, namely the four applications of mindfulness. So why we practice is to reduce or to overcome suffering, in a nutshell. And there are many, many levels of motivation for meditation practice, for mindfulness practice, and we don't need to, I don't think, even be clear about, you know, how far do we want to take this? Do we just want a bit of peace of mind, a bit of stress management, or do we really want, you know, complete release, nirvana, complete escape from suffering? They're all about freedom from suffering. And at some level, that probably is what brought us all here. It might be that what brings us to practice is life is at the time very difficult. There's a lot going on, a lot of suffering, and we have a sense that this might show us the way out. It might be that life is fairly okay. Everything's going quite well, but there's just that sense of unease. Isn't there more to it than this? So, you know, that is also what's meant here by suffering. Suffering's too big a word, really, for the Pali word that some of you will know is dukkha. It's just that kind of sense that things aren't quite right, that sense of unease about life. And the Buddha says this is a sure path. Literally, he actually says it's a one-way street. Ekayana maga, one-way street. It only leads in one direction. If we practice, it can only lead in the direction of reducing suffering. Why it should do that, I hope will become clear, if it hasn't already become clear in your own practice. I hope it may become clear in some of what I say. But that is very much something to experience, and everything I say, you know, here is something to check out in your own experience and not to just take at face value. So then, still very much in the introduction to the sutta, the Buddha offers a summary of what we practice, what we should be mindful of. So he says, what are these four applications? So he says, now a meditator constantly observes the body as a body, being ardent, fully attentive and mindful, curbing covetousness and discontent in the world. And then he repeats that for feelings. He observes feelings as feelings, the state of mind or the mind as a state of mind, and experiences or mental events, I'll say more about this later, as experiences. In each case, being ardent, fully attentive and mindful, curbing covetousness and discontent. So these are the four, and I'll say a little bit about each of them. But just in that paragraph, just to note, he uses this word ardent, and the word in Pali implies the heat of ardour. I said on a retreat recently to a Kinshino, ardour makes me think of medieval love poems, ardent. And he sort of grinned and said, yeah, that's how we should feel about this practice, you know, love, devotion, application to the practice. And putting aside covetousness and discontent, at least to some extent, in order to be practicing, we've all probably, even to be here, we have some inkling that covetousness for things and pushing things away, discontent, doesn't make us happy and perpetuates dukkha. So we put them aside to some extent for the duration of the practice at least. So then the rest of the bulk of the sutta really is the Buddha's unpacking of these four aspects of our experience, these four qualities, or these four perspectives on our experience really, the body, the physical experience, feeling just in the sense of the hedonic tone of our experience, pleasant or unpleasant, the state of mind, which is more the affective or emotional, and then the events, the experiences in the mind, the more cognitive, you might say. But these don't occur in isolation. We experience them all together. But for our practice, for training in mindfulness, it can be helpful to separate them, to take them one by one. So the sutta, the text, sutta just means a discourse or a talk. It invites us to recognize them in our experience and to investigate how we relate to them. Are we relating to our body, our feelings, our mind in a way that fuels suffering and discontent, or in a way that leads to ease and kindness and contentment? That's really what it's all about. So it begins with the body. And the first section is, in fact, the section on in and out breathing. So it begins where we began today. And the Buddha says, the meditator goes into the wild, or to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, crosses his or her legs, holds his body straight, and brings mindfulness to the fore. It's interesting, actually, that this is the only reference in the sutta to sitting meditation per se. So mindfulness is a lot more than what we do in sitting. The rest of the text can be done in sitting practice, but it can be done in everyday life as well. But the sitting practice, and particularly the mindfulness of breathing, is a real foundation for everything. So why the breath? Yeah, what are the qualities of the breath? I said to somebody earlier in a one-to-one, and I think it's important to note that it's not always the breath that's the most helpful anchor point for everybody. Sometimes the breath is tied up with some difficulty. So it can be the body generally, the contact points of the ground or one hand on the other. But the breath does have this quality of being very dynamic. It's constantly moving. And it also, it's the only thing I think that we do, that we can both do deliberately, take a breath, and that happens by itself 24/7 without us thinking about it. So I think that helps us to, it helps the connection between body and mind. The breath seems to have that slightly unusual quality. And it connects us to the body as a whole anyway, watching the breath. So we start the whole practice of mindfulness with the body. Even though you could say all our suffering is in the mind and the heart, you know, it's our relationship to things, but we feel thoughts and emotions in the body. So without body awareness, we can't really be fully aware of our emotional life, and we tend to be driven by our emotions and thoughts if we're not connected with the body. So we're beginning here to heal the kind of mind-body dualism, which was probably around in the Buddha's time, but perhaps particularly infects us in the West since the days of Descartes. And so then he just says, mindful, one breathes in, mindful, one breathes out. Breathing in a long breath, we know that. Breathing in a short breath, we know that. So we're not changing the breath in any way, but just noticing the breath. And just to go back a little bit in the introduction, when he says he observes the body as a body, just a couple of things to say about that. It's a very visual metaphor, perhaps because the eyes are our strongest sense, but it doesn't mean observing at a distance in a detached kind of way. It's really sensing into the body, you know, we could even say tasting the body or listening to the body, but again, not, you know, from the inside. And the as a body, this comes up quite a lot in the sutta, observing things as they are. So the idea is seeing the body, feeling the body, experiencing the body just as it is, without the whole story that we so often fabricate about it. It's old, it's young, it's attractive or not, it's fat or thin, it's mine. It's the main story we fabricate about it. So just really experiencing the body just as it is. Maybe say more about that later. So then he goes on to encourage us to practice so that we can breathe in, fully experiencing the whole body, calming the activities of the body. And so as well as the breath, fully experiencing the whole body and then calming the activities of the body. And there's an interesting image here. It says, just as a skilled wood turner or his apprentice, while making a long turn, this is a turn of the lathe, he knows that he's making a long turn. While making a short turn, he knows he's making a short turn. Likewise, we know when we breathe, it's a long breath or a short breath, and we experience and calm the body. This fully experiencing, it's like even more intimate than knowing. Fully in there, experiencing it. And the analogy, I think, is of a very skilled craftsperson, an artisan, who really knows their craft, a very embodied knowing, not having to think about it. So that's what we're cultivating. There's then a little refrain where the Buddha talks about how we do this, and I'm going to say a bit more about that later, so I won't read that now. So then he goes through various other sections on the body. I mean, this might sound like enough, and in many ways it is enough, just to sit and breathe and calm the body and become more aware of the body. There's another text called The Mindfulness of In and Out Breathing, where the whole practice of mindfulness of breathing is described as a path to complete liberation. So, you know, that's the foundation. But he then just really unpacks it and goes into details. So the next one, he says, when a meditator is walking, he or she knows that. When standing, knows that. When seated, knows that. When lying down, knows that. He or she knows the body's posture, whatever it is. So it's not just about sitting, really, all that he's saying. These are the four postures: sitting, walking, seated, lying down. There's not much else we can be doing, really. So encouraging us to sustain that sense of being embodied in all situations. And then there's a section where he talks about paying attention in all our activities, and the word that's used there it's not quite the same word as mindfulness. It means something like full or clear comprehension. So it's really having a sense of according to the commentary, it includes knowing what our purpose is and knowing whether what we're doing is suitable for that. But I think all it's saying is perhaps a slightly different kind of awareness in everyday life, because the things he's talking about here, he says we act with full attention while going forward or returning, while looking ahead or looking away, bending or stretching, while wearing your robes and carrying your bowl. Well, that's monks, but, you know, just getting dressed, really, and eating. While eating, drinking, chewing, tasting, while defecating and urinating, he acts with full attention, walking, standing, seated, falling asleep, waking up, talking, being silent. We could probably add other things to the list, checking your emails, talking on the phone, things that they didn't do in those days, but basically nothing is left out. That's what he's saying. This isn't, I think we need to be careful here, this isn't some sort of we have to be mindful 24/7. You know, and it can all get very precious and we're trying to be mindful. I think it's just saying all of our life is an opportunity to practice awareness. That there isn't a place where we can think, I can't do it here, I'll take a break. We can bring awareness to everything we do. And it just really deepens that quality of being present, being aware, and noticing then the mental and emotional states that might drive us in ways that are unhelpful. So then, still on the body, conscious of time, but there's a rather a lot on the body. The next one is a kind of body scan, so I won't say too much about it. It describes noticing, scanning the body and just reflecting on all the things it's made up of. Head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bone marrow, kidneys, heart. It's quite anatomical, there's a long list. And he compares it to a bag full of different kinds of grains. Rice, mung beans, lentils, sesame seeds, and if a man with good eyesight were to look at them, he could tell them apart. So, although the text actually uses the word impurities, I think that's perhaps a bit of a monastic bias about the body, that the image of the rice is very impersonal and dispassionate, just saying this is what our body is made up of. And a bit like the elements practice that we did earlier, it's just beginning to soften our tendency to see it in terms of I, me and mine, to be particularly attached to this particular location in the universe that is my body. And the next section is the section on the elements that we did the practice. So this is ancient Indian classification of earth, water, fire and air, which refers to these qualities of solidity, fluidity, temperature and movement. So he invites us to scan this same body, whatever its location, whatever its posture, in terms of the elements. In this body, there are the elements of earth, water, fire, and air. But as we saw earlier, not as an intellectual exercise, but as an experience. So a couple of other bits, I think I'll move on. So one important thing to say about these two sections, we're not saying here that the body is in itself problematic or has no value. You know, the body is where we have our life. It's very precious. We can relate to it with much care and much appreciation, but without clinging to it being a certain way or a certain experience of it as mine, as something that we want to hold on to. We don't want it to change. We don't want it to do things we don't like get sick or have pain, but just a much more profound appreciation of the body with all its changes and problems and difficulties. And the next section, the final section on the body, is perhaps the most challenging. It's called the Nine Cemetery section. Perhaps don't need to say any more. It's not nine cemeteries, actually. It's nine things that happen in the cemetery. Cemetery here in the ancient India was just a place outside town where bodies were dumped, sometimes translated charnel ground. And he describes, and I won't read it all, I'll spare you that, but he describes nine stages of what happens to a corpse when it's thrown into the charnel ground. It starts after 2 or 3 days, bloated, discoloured and festering, and it goes on to gradual decomposition till it's just a skeleton, then it's just a few bones lying around. And at the end, he says, bones that have become rotten and crumbled to dust. So you go through all these stages, but for each of them it says, he or she makes a comparison with his own body. This body too is of this nature. It is sure to become like this. It is not exempt from this. So it's quite strong, and it's repeated. Every bit is repeated. He has, I'll mention a couple of them, just don't want to spare you too much. He says, just as if a meditator were looking at a body being eaten by crows or hawks or vultures and various other creatures, or just as if he were looking at a body with bones that have become disconnected, scattered in various directions, here a hand bone, there a foot bone, etc. So he really labours the point. And after every one, there is this refrain. It's repeat the refrain that we'll talk about in a minute. It's repeated. So I think this is to overcome our denial. You know, we don't want to know this. And so it doesn't allow us, in a way, to skip over this section. And it's very traditional in the Buddhist tradition to reflect on aging, sickness and death as something that we have not gone beyond, we are not exempt from. So, this isn't very often perhaps focused on in the West. We don't do this practice often on retreats, although if you come to Gaia House, you'll know there is a skeleton in the walking room, and really it's there for this kind of contemplation. But I think it's very important that this is not something morbid, and it's not about, in a way, it's not so much about focusing on death, it's about making life more meaningful and more precious. Really keeping everything in that perspective. If we don't really face up to, you know, what is the body is going to age, grow sick and die, well, firstly, we might not... traditionally it's said that we won't take the possibility of practice and awakening seriously because we keep distracting ourselves by looking in the wrong places for happiness, for contentment. The Buddha, as you probably know, when he first went forth from home to practice, it said that he did so because he either saw literally or reflected on aging, sickness, death, and the spiritual path. He's said to have seen an old man, a sick man, a dead man, and a monastic practitioner, a wandering mendicant. And it was the first three of those four sights that gave him the sense of urgency to practice. So whether or not we have a belief in rebirth, if we really know that time is precious, time is not, you know, we're not here forever, then we really think about, well, what do we want to do with this time? But as I say, I think it's just really important that it's not meant to depress or make us feel morbid. It's about really how do we live our lives if we know that we're going to die. So I'd like to share with you one of my favourite quotes on this. This is not from the Buddha, this is from Steve Jobs. And whatever we might think of him or Apple, I think he really touches the spot here. And after he died, this was quoted a lot. And I stuck it up on my wall at home. And I just find it really, if I feel a bit worried about the future, I just read this. So he said this. He said it about a year or two after being diagnosed with cancer. Remembering that I'll be dead soon, it's the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. So that might work for you better than crumbling skeletons. The point is the same. It's how do we live our life knowing that we're going to die? So moving on to the other aspects, which I'll say a little less about, but it's all in the text. So the second one, a much shorter section of the text, but in some ways definitely equally importantly, is what is usually translated feelings, the word vedana, terribly difficult to put into English. It means the initial feeling sensation. When we have any sense contact or mental experience, it is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So if I ring the bell, we may experience that just as a pleasant sound. If it's at the end of the meditation, we may experience a very pleasant sound. We might not actually like the sound of bells. It might be unpleasant. It might feel quite neutral. So this doesn't imply anything like emotions. We use the word feelings often to mean emotions, but that comes under the third and fourth of the applications of mindfulness. This is just the basic feeling of pleasant and unpleasant. It's influenced by our past experience, but it's arising here and now in the present. And it's a very important aspect of mindfulness because it has a place in the kind of chain of dependent arising that tends to lead to suffering, which is whenever there's a contact, we have this feeling tone arises, and then generally, without even noticing, immediately we're into, I want more if it's pleasant, I don't want it if it's unpleasant. And if it's neutral, I get a bit confused or bored. I'm not sure what to do with it. And then we start to cling to the pleasant, push away the unpleasant, and just repeat. All our old habits get that bit stronger. So traditionally, this is really said to be a very, very important point to notice in our practice. That moment where feeling becomes wanting or not wanting. That's the point where we can break that chain and reduce our suffering. So feeling in this sense is unavoidable, but it's how we respond to it that matters. We can't make pleasant experiences unpleasant. You know, if I'm being distracted in the walking practice by smelling lunch, I can't make that unpleasant if it isn't. If I have a pain in my knee, I can't pretend it's pleasant. But we can notice it and we can begin to choose our response. So if we can be really mindful of feeling, we can begin to slow the process down so that we're not just drawn towards things that we cling to or away from things we don't like. And to that extent, we're free. It's interesting to think when we want things, you know, if I want a good meal or if I want to go to a party or if I want something, what I really want is the pleasant feelings that I think this is going to give me. So it really drives our lives. And, you know, Dharma practice isn't about taking the joy out of our life, it's about taking the clinging out of it, the point where suffering begins. And the neutral feeling, I think, is quite interesting. And we often miss neutral, but with training in meditation, we become more aware of neutral experiences and often see that they're subtly pleasant or unpleasant. But also how when our feeling is a bit neutral, we want to fill it with distraction and entertainment very often. So there's a little passage where the Buddha just invites us. He just says, when a meditator is having a pleasant feeling, they know that. When having an unpleasant feeling, they know that. When having a neutral feeling, they know that. He also makes a distinction between pleasant and unpleasant feelings that are linked to the senses. So this is translated differently, and sometimes it's translated worldly and spiritual, but I think what it... Perhaps the key distinction is whether there is attachment present or not. So we can notice a pleasant feeling and notice the clinging and grasping that's coming with it. Or we can notice a pleasant feeling and we can notice that maybe in that moment there isn't very much grasping. And that's quite important to really see that. So there's a lot more I could say about feeling, but I think I'll move on. So the third... application of mindfulness is the state of mind or the mind itself. Citta is the word and it means heart and mind. It's the emotional mind. It's mind in a much wider sense than we perhaps normally use the term. Sometimes just translated consciousness really. It's the where we experience our mood states and our emotions. And so the Buddha says, how does a meditator constantly observe the state of mind as a state of mind? When the mind is affected by, I've written passion here, but greed really, they know that. And when it's freed from greed, he knows that. When it's affected by malice or ill will, we know that. When it's freed from that, we know it. When it's affected by confusion, we know that. When it's freed from confusion, we know that. And there's a list of other pairs of opposites: expansive, contracted, limited, limitless, composed, unsettled. The details don't really matter. This is just our inner climate. So it's about knowing the specific, knowing what's going on in our mind. And notice that it's about knowing. It doesn't tell us to suppress or change or apply antidotes to unwholesome, unhelpful mental states, but to really know them. That includes really knowing where they lead. So we can know that if we just give in to this ill will or confusion, it'll just get worse. It might lead to unhelpful consequences. But we need to really know that. We need to really acknowledge our mental state. That's the first step towards changing anything. So this is, as I say, this is our inner climate and it colours our experience of events. So if we don't notice it, then things happen without us really understanding why. I think I touched on earlier, you know, if we wake up in the morning feeling a bit grumpy or irritated and we don't notice that, it will have ramifications throughout our day without us quite knowing why. And if we wake up feeling quite happy and peaceful, well, great to notice that and not just take it for granted and notice how that affects our day. So we're really being encouraged here to discern which states of mind are helpful in the sense that they support calmness, ease, kindness, joy, and which states of mind fuel suffering. So states of mind, they show up in the content of our thoughts, although that comes in more to the next section. This is also about just recognizing thoughts as thoughts and just inquiring, you know, what state of mind is this thought arising from? And what will happen if I just run with it? If I jump on this train of thought, where might it be going? And see if we can just catch it. So the fourth section is the word in Pali, which many of you will know, is Dhamma. It's incredibly difficult to translate. Sometimes it's translated mental and physical events. I've translated it experiences, but it's the moment-by-moment things that we experience, phenomena of our experience. And it also means the teaching itself. So I think the implication here is we're being invited to observe our experiences in the light of our understanding of the teachings of the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching. And so there are various lists that we're presented with in this section, and I won't go through all of them, but where we're encouraged to observe our experience. And the first one is to observe our experiences in terms of the teachings on the five hindrances. And we all know these, even if you've not heard of the five hindrances, you know them. These are the kind of obstacles, really, to clarity, to presence, to connection. These are the unhelpful mind states by which we disconnect with what's going on in our meditation practice, but actually in nearly all difficult mental states. So much so that we often see them as normal. They just can become the shape of our mind. So what the Buddha says is when sense desire is present in one knows that. When it's absent, we know that. We know how if it's not present, if it's latent or unarisen, we know what makes it active. We know how it's given up. And we know how it will not arise again. And this is repeated for the others, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, agitation and worry and doubt or indecision. So these are the five hindrances. The first pair, which is basically desire versus aversion, wanting and not wanting. The second two are another pair, agitation and dullness. And the final one is the kind of corrosive doubt that undermines our practice. But again, the emphasis is on to know them rather than to try and stop them or suppress them. And to know the process, what leads to their arising, what leads to their passing, what actually helps us to work with a hindrance. I was reading earlier an engineering analogy around this, that if you really understand something, you also know how it fails and how it recovers, if it's a machine or a software system. That part of really knowing something is knowing how it disappears and how it re-arises. So if we really know what mindfulness is, in a way, we also know how it fails. It fails when we get drawn into ill will. It doesn't fail, it's not quite the word, but we notice its absence and we notice how it recovers. But it's all about noticing. And that's why the word fail isn't very good, because it's not about judging. It's about just really seeing how the mind works. And the more we see that, the more what is helpful begins to, in a way, it just becomes obvious to us to pay attention in more helpful ways. We don't have to ask the question, is this helpful or not? The Buddha compared it to picking up hot coal. You don't need to say, well, this seems to be burning my hand. Should I put it down? You just drop it. You know, when we see that something is not helpful, we put it down. But we won't see that unless we really explore and investigate. So the next, I might miss a couple of sections out actually. He then goes through various different ways of categorizing our experience. The first one that some of you will know is a list of five, literally heaps. It's like the building blocks of what we cling to, particularly what gives us our sense of self, our sense of me, the things we grasp as mine. And they are form, our physical form, the feeling that we've talked about, our perception, our habitual tendencies, and our consciousness. The term that's used in Pali, khanda, in ancient India it was used for bundles of firewood. So this is kind of, when we cling to this, like fire clings to firewood, there's a burning. The fire metaphor is quite strong. You know, it implies something quite painful if we cling to these. So bringing our attention to them, well, we've talked about the body, which is an aspect of form and feeling. So we bring attention also to perception, which is our tendency to, well, we recognize things. That's very useful. You know, when we see something, we recognize it. We don't have to keep relearning things. But it means that we tend to be influenced by our past assumptions, our preconceptions. So with mindfulness, what we're encouraged to do is to see things afresh, to see things with what the Zen practitioners call beginner's mind, so that our process of recognition can just be very clear. It doesn't have to stray into proliferation of thoughts. So we see someone we know, we just say, oh, there's so-and-so. We don't have to go into, oh, I know what they're like. I remember last time we met. Oh, yes. Before we know it, we've kind of prejudged what's going to happen. And we're not fresh. The person may have changed. Our whole relationship with them could change. There's a Zen story of two travelers traveling from place to place. And they ask a farmer what the people are like in the next town. And he asks them what they were like in the last town. And so one of them says, oh, they were grumpy and bad-tempered and I really didn't like them. They didn't make me welcome. And the other one, who's been in the same town, says, oh, they were really friendly and warm and kind and made me very welcome. So the farmer says to both of them, I think you'll find they're much the same in the next place. So I think it's a lovely image for how we can create our experience, really, through not being mindful of that tendency to bring the past into the present and into the future. Which very strongly relates to the next of these qualities, which is our habitual tendencies, the way we construct the world, really. We misperceive the world through what we make of our experience, based on our past conditioning, but then repeated. So we have our experience, but then we fabricate a story, a perception around it, and then that becomes our experience. Could be quite useful when you notice you're not present, when we notice we're not mindful. I mean, in that moment, we are mindful. When we notice it, it can be worth just noticing, what was I constructing a minute ago? What was I fabricating? Just be really clear, was it helpful or not? And in the tradition, even wholesome habits can be inflexible. You know, the idea is ultimately that we react spontaneously rather than habitually. But of course, cultivating skillful habits can be very, very helpful on the path. So just to really notice those. He then talks about the senses. It's just another way of categorizing experience. So I won't go into them, but the final, the penultimate list is the seven qualities of awakening, and I think it's really worth mentioning those because we're so often much more aware of problematic mental events than helpful ones, wholesome ones. So it's really important to notice what is present when all these hindrances and difficulties are absent. What can we cultivate? The Buddha describes this in terms of seven qualities of experience that are cultivated in the process of awakening, the pr- process of becoming more and more alert, awake, free, ultimately. And the first one, he goes through in the same sort of way. He says, a meditator observes experiences in terms of the seven qualities of awakening. When mindfulness as a quality of awakening is present, a meditator knows it is present. When it is absent, they know it is absent. They know when it is absent how it becomes active, and how when it is activated, it is cultivated to fulfillment. So mindfulness is the first one. You might not be surprised to know, really. It's the foundation of the list. The second one is investigation of experience, inquiry into our experience. So really, this is what we're being invited to do in the whole text and in our practice. So mindfulness, again, it's not just being present, but it's really exploring, investigating our experience. The next few I won't say too much about. There's energy, which is just the dedication, the effort, the vitality in our practice. The next one is joy, so, or sometimes translated interest. We're drawn to things we're interested in. There's tranquility and concentration. And then the final one is equanimity, which I just wanted to say a little about. Equanimity, the word in Pali literally means looking over things equally or impartially. It's a sense of whatever is going on, really. It's a quality of our relationship to things, that we're not invested in things being a certain way. We're not clinging to things being a certain way. So these are the seven qualities of awakening, of Bodhi. The word that's very often translated enlightenment, but I think awakening or knowing is much more what it's describing. The next section is the four truths, which I think I won't say very much about, really, but this is the present, the existence of suffering, what causes it, the fact that it can be ended, and the path. Gets us. It's harder to contemplate this so much as an experience, because it's a bit more of a doctrine, may have been added later to the text. But the key thing is the relationship between our wanting mind, our wanting things to be different, and whether we experience unsatisfactoriness or not. But I want to just touch on the refrain. I can find where I put it down. Here's one. So this is repeated for all the sections. Are you still with me? Sorry, I'm aware this is all a bit tense. So we've had the initial injunction of why we practice. We practice to overcome sorrow and discontent, to experience relief, basically to reduce suffering. And then what we apply this mindful awareness to is our bodily experience, this feeling tone, our states of mind, and our experiences, really our thoughts and feelings, in terms of these various categories. Are we experiencing hindrances, or are we experiencing qualities of awakening? Are we noticing our perception? Is it leading into repeating our old tendencies or not? And then there's just this little refrain that's repeated several times, and so often it's abbreviated by translators, and we often skip over it, but it just describes the general attitude to take in our practice, to all these practices. So even if we're not doing any of these and we're just staying with the breath, just to be aware of this, it's more about the process, really, of how we experience insight by doing all this. So what he says is, I'll just read this out. This is the one about the body, but it's repeated for feelings, mind states, and experiences. It says, in this way, one constantly observes the body as a body, subjectively or objectively, or both, subjectively or inwardly and objectively. He observes experiences arising in the body, or he observes experiences passing in the body, or he constantly observes experiences arising and passing in the body. or his mindfulness of the body as it is becomes established up to the point of understanding and steady mindfulness. He remains independent and does not cling to anything in the world. That is how a meditator constantly observes the body as a body. So basically, what he's implying is that the basic instructions include four things. The first one we've already seen, experiencing the body as a body, seeing it in and of itself, just as it is, seeing our feelings as they are, our states of mind as they are. But the second one is quite interesting, inwardly and externally or objectively. It's often translated inwardly and externally, actually, might be a better way of putting it. Inwardly is obvious, we've been talking about this, this is being aware of our own experience of our body and our mind state. Externally is understood in lots of different ways in the tradition. And the commentary says it means being aware of other people. And I used to think, well, that's a bit nutty. You've gone into the forest on your own, and observing other people's bodies might be a bit of a distraction, and observing other people's feelings and mind states is a bit tricky. So, but what I think, and this is just really my thought, slightly influenced by listening to Joseph Goldstein and how he talks about this, I think what it's implying is that within the practice, whether there are other people present or not, that we maintain an awareness that whatever we're experiencing is ultimately no different for others, that it's the same for everyone else. You know, when I'm sitting being aware of my body and its pains and my mind and its whatever's coming up, you know, I want to be comfortable, and that's true for others too. If I resist unpleasant feelings, I suffer, and that's true for other people too. My mind can be full of greed and ill will, and that's true for other people too. Sometimes I experience joy and energy and equanimity, and that's true of other people too. There's this just real sense of it, we don't have to take any of it very personally. Of course, we have our specific story and our specific conditionings and our history, but we have a lot more in common than what divides us. And I think this experiencing the body and the mind externally is really a basis for a compassionate understanding of what others also experience, which we can, of course, infer in everyday life through meeting people, but even in meditation. And I think without that self-other perspective, mindfulness could seem very self-referential. You know, we sit there with our eyes closed and we bring our attention within. Or even if we're going around in our day mindfully, it can feel like it's all about me. And I think just having that sense of awareness of others within our practice adds that element of compassion to the practice. And the next thing was experiences arising and passing. I probably don't need to say much about this. I mentioned it earlier this morning, but this is really fundamental to the practice, that if we see things arising and passing, we see the change in the world. This is foundational to insight and awakening. I think it's no accident that of all the aspects of experience that the teaching, the text could be inviting us to pay attention to, impermanence is the one. And this is intellectually very obvious. Change is happening all around us, change in the seasons, change in the weather, change in our bodies as we age, change in society, change in technology. But we still manage to be shocked sometimes when things change, or when people change, or when things break, when things get lost, when people die. So if impermanence is all around us, it's just worth reflecting on what is the liberating power of really seeing it. The Buddha said somewhere, it would be better to live one day seeing the truth of change than to live for 100 years not seeing it. And this is ultimately because this is when we can start to see that we suffer a lot because we tend to expect much more from things than they can give us. We invest so much more in people, experiences, possessions. So the Buddha said, when we really see impermanence, we become disillusioned, not in the sense of a cynical disillusionment, but free of illusions. We can still love people. We can still enjoy our experiences. We can still like our things. But we know that they can only give us what they can give us and not more. And so we then free ourselves from trying to hold on to some things more than is possible or push others away. We just see things really as they are. There was a piece of research in New York that showed that people, human beings, tend to overestimate how much pleasure any new experience or thing or possession can give them and for how long. And I thought that was really interesting. Around the time I read that, I just got a new car. Yeah, my new car makes me very happy. I'm not denying that, but it's only going to make me this happy for this long, you know. That's all it is. It's a vehicle. And so it's not about pretending that things don't give us pleasure. I think the whole practice is about increasing the joy in our lives, but not investing more in things than they can give us, or expecting that initial excitement of a new holiday or thing or relationship is going to not change. There was an interview with the man who did the research in the New York Times, and he said, I haven't really taken any note of my own research because I'm getting married in the spring and I think it will make me very happy for a very long time. And I hope it did, but, you know, there was an acknowledgement there that we somehow want to hold on to it. We invest so much in it, in whatever is giving us pleasure. So when we see that, the other characteristics I mentioned earlier, the tendency to, the kind of anguish that occurs when we resist what is happening, want it to be different, and that sense of it not really being personal, that these become clearer as well. So when we see that, as the refrain says, then we experience insight and steady mindfulness. So at this point, our mindfulness becomes natural. It happens by itself. And we clearly see. We have the understanding, as I mentioned earlier, the seeing that is freeing. You know, seeing or understanding is always understood in this tradition as something that frees us from suffering, much more than mere knowledge. And then the refrain says, we remain independent and not clinging to anything in the world. Because through the practice, we've seen the futility of clinging to things that are constantly changing. So we see where the end of our dissatisfaction, our unease, our anguish does and does not lie. So the invitation is to really investigate this. You know, this is what the Buddha is saying. So is it true in your experience that if we cling, if we see the source of our dissatisfaction outside of ourselves, we suffer? And what happens if we follow the Buddha's radically different suggestion, which is that contentment and well-being come from our internal state and how we relate to the world? The key to contentment isn't whether we have pleasant experiences or not, pleasant possessions or not, which is mostly out of our control, but how we relate to our experiences. So in our practice, by taking, particularly in meditation practice, by quieting down everything that's happening around us, by coming into our experience, we can see it in everyday life as well. When we see everything that's arising to our senses, then we start to notice these threads of clinging, threads of desire. And all these words, clinging, craving, desire, they're really a bit too strong. Andrew Olenksky, an American teacher, calls it the subtle wantings of the mind for things to be like this or like that. Not quite like this, not quite like that. Very subtle. And so then our practice just is to gently surrender to that and just adapt to this moment. This is how it is. And just see what happens. But the suggestion, the invitation, and Olenksky goes on to say this, happiness is not pursued and attained. It is rather discovered and uncovered within. And so this is something that we can taste as a glimpses throughout our practice, and maybe at some point can become an effortless and lasting state. And according to the Buddha, if we cultivate these four applications of mindfulness, and firstly he says for 7 years, and then by a process of elimination he brings it down to 7 days. If we practice this for 7 days, one or other of two results is to be expected. Perfect knowledge, freedom, in this very life, or if a trace of clinging remains, the state of non-returning. That's a technical Buddhist term, but the implication is that we never fall back into the previous suffering. So he concludes, it is on this basis that I said that this is a sure path for the purification of beings, to overcome sorrow and grief, to end suffering and discontent, to find an effective training, to experience release, namely the four applications of mindfulness. So the Blessed One spoke. Delighted, the monks acclaimed his words. So let's just have a minute or so of silence.